Indeed, Your Honor.
I'll ask the clerk to call the case, please.
The court will now call Lloyd Waltershide and Waltershide Farms LLC versus Danny Waltershide and LI Group Incorporated DBA Red River Livestock Auction. May it please the court, Mr. Mark Howell will argue for the appellate. Mr. Darrell Comer will argue for the appellate.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, Mark Howell and Mark Frels for the appellants. This involves my client getting involved in what I'll call a cattle purchase transaction. The appellee solicited my client to invest money in a cattle purchase transaction whereby my client would put up the purchase money to buy the cattle, that a man named Clint Sicking would in fact buy the cattle and graze the cattle, fatten the cattle, and eventually sell the cattle. At the time of the sale, my client would get his money back and the profit would be split three ways between my client on the one hand, Mr. Sicking on the other hand, and the appellee on the third hand. The appellee actually took my client's money. The checks were written to the appellee. He deposited those checks into his personal banking account. He actually gave receipts to my client. He promised my client that he would watch over the cattle. He would keep an accounting of what was going on with the cattle. I note that he testified at trial in retrospect that his records of this accounting looked like it was all phony, I quote, quote unquote. There was actually a repayment check. He wrote it out of his personal account and gave it to my client. My client lost $873,000 in seven transactions over 2 months on cattle transactions that he did at the request of the appellee. Until the end of this transaction, the appellee was the only person that my client ever dealt with regard to these transactions. Now, what is important here is everything I have just told you is not contested. This is all conceded by everybody. This is what happened. Now, what's interesting is virtually none of these things found their way into the findings of fact that were done by the trial court. The trial court ended up with some findings of fact that basically are, you know, we have jurisdiction and things like that, and really did not make any real fact findings on any of what we would consider to be the controlling fact issues in the case. The court then made three, what I'll call kind of amalgamated findings. And the one that is, there's two that are important here today. The first one was that the evidence was legally insufficient to support a finding that there was a valid enforceable contract between my client and the appellee that was breached by the appellee. So the whole point is that whether or not this is a finding of fact or a conclusion of law in the court's mind is very difficult for us to determine. However, what we do know for certain that on the issue of whether or not a contract exists and whether a contract is formed, that it is not a fact-finding, it is a question of law. And we certainly recognize and understand the heavy burden we would carry in trying to overturn a fact-finding. But in this case, where the determination is whether or not a contract existed in the first place between these people, this is a, I hate to say it to you, a de novo review by the court. I think the court has to review all of the evidence and make a determination as a matter of law, as the trial court should have, as to whether or not a contract was formed. Now, it would seem to me, being a relatively naive and young trial lawyer, that the facts that I told you in the beginning about how everything that happened with regard to this transaction, the solicitation, the money, the repayment, the promises to watch over, all these things, I confess I don't understand how someone came to the conclusion that that was not a binding contract.
Maybe it was because there were terms of the contract that were unagreed to, apparently. I mean, there was testimony that maybe he got 15%, maybe he got 20%. When was it going to be paid? Well, maybe then or maybe another time. Well, could it be because there were missing terms of the contract?
Well, I think Justice Gabriel, you have hit on the defendant's position pretty well here. But what we say is that, first off, there was a good deal of evidence about the term of this contract. And the evidence was that it would basically be done at sale, number one, that was unquestioned, it would be divided, and number two, that until the wheat ran out, which was a term of art, because they were feeding this cattle on wheat, these cattle on wheat, and when the wheat would be expended, that they would sell the cattle. The third thing is we've set forth in the brief that the court has the power, based upon the circumstances that it's presented with, and here we have a course of dealing where, you know, a pretty standardized course of dealing with regard to these seven, there were actually nine transactions, but
well,
the seven transactions.
Not to interrupt you, but I think Justice Gabriel has hit on something that I was curious about, too, is the dispute that we have as to whether all the material terms are met or not, and I would ask you, your briefing to the court, you rely upon the Hubbell case out of this court related to continuing contracts. In order to disagree with the trial court and for us to determine de novo that there was a contract in this case, do we have to find there's a continuing contract?
No, but we think there was. We have taken the position that we think that this is a continuing contract, that going over these, at least these seven transactions where all the money went to the appellee, yes, we consider that to be a continuing contract. We believe that the decisions of the courts with regard to continuing contracts apply to this. It's not limited just to construction contracts. And we think that the concept of the continuing contract is valid even in this case of an oral contract. There we found no cases that restricted it to a written contract. So yes, we believe this was a continuing contract.
We don't have to find that it's a continuing contract for us to find that there is a contract.
I do not believe so, sir. I think that you can look at them individually. Now, if you look at them individually, to go back to Justice Gabriel's question, then the question becomes the profit. How is the profit to be split? And the defendant takes the position, the appellee takes the position, that that was a differential between the contracts, and that is he concedes that the first two transactions he was supposed to get a third of the profit. He concedes that. My client testified that he thought he was going to get a third of the profit through all of the transactions as a result of being the facilitator who put these transactions together. And so we do not see this as being some kind of a material problem with regard to an element of the contract, as Justice Gabriel pointed out. We don't think that the term is a material problem because in the final analysis, if the term was not sufficiently defined by the parties, the court has the right, at law, under appellate decisions, to imply a reasonable term in the contract. And this, again, I think we can strain over a gnat. They'd buy 50 head of cattle, they'd fatten them, and they'd sell them. I mean, everybody understood what this was going to be. And the term of the contract was going to be when the wheat ran out and when the cattle were fat, and they sell them. And so we don't believe that these so-called missing terms are really material, and to the extent they are, they're either defined and proven, or the court can impose a reasonable position over what the term was. I likewise have no difficulty when the court finds that there is no breach by Mr. Walterscheid in this finding. We paid him we gave this gentleman $873,000 and basically got nothing back. And it seems to us that as a matter of law, if there is one contract, seven contracts, or however many contracts, the bottom line is we didn't get our money back. And that is a breach of the contract. That's number one. Number two, this gentleman told us, and we relied on it, and he doesn't deny this, that he would watch over our investments, that he would watch over these things, which he obviously didn't do, it's clear from the record. And likewise, he was going to keep records and keep an accounting, which it is also obvious from the record that what he did, he didn't even think was too good because he said it all looked like it was phony, the records that he did do. So we believe that we have, in fact, established that there was a contract as a matter of law. I think we've established that we did, in fact, suffer a breach as a result of the actions of the appellee.
Now, I'm going to go back to your contract as a matter of law for just a moment, because you say the court can imply reasonable terms.
Yes, ma'am.
But if there weren't payments made, then how is the court supposed to imply a reasonable term of repayment? Is it a third? Is it 20%? Is it 15%? There wasn't a course of conduct upon which to base that.
Well, and first of all, we're clear, Justice Gabriel. As far as the percentage, I think it's undisputed that that in the original two, it's conceded they were supposed to play a one-third, one-third, one-third. But as far as the timing goes, please understand.
Well, for the rest of the other seven or however many there were after that, what was the repayment term? Was it a third? Was it 15%? Was it 20%? How is the court supposed to provide that?
My client testified that he thought it was a third, a third, a third straight through, number one. Number two, the appellee testified that after the first two transactions that it was going to be split between Mr. Sicking and my client, that he would not be a participant in the five remaining transactions. And I think it's important for the court to note that these transactions didn't take place.
Well, the court had the opportunity to believe one or the other, but couldn't believe that there was no terms agreed upon.
Oh, I think that is true. But I think, as we've set forth in the brief, the critical thing here is that in a case such as this, that the court has to look to some kind of an objective standard. And the objective things would be supported by objective facts. The only evidence before the court with regard to the change in the terms from one-third, one-third, one-third to half and half is the appellee's testimony. That's the only testimony that's before the court. And as we set forth in the brief, he had kind of a bad record of some of the things he testified to under oath, for example, at deposition. And I think this is important when we get to the non-disclosure. And that is, he testified that when he did the first, in deposition, he testified when he did the first deal with my client, when he solicited my client the first time, that Mr. Sicking had already cheated him, his words, out of $120,000. And that the one-third he was to receive out of my client's profits was to pay him back for the money he had been cheated out of. Now, he reneged on that testimony at the time of trial, and he changed his testimony, and it's all in the record where there's a long colloquy between he and I over the fact that this is completely inconsistent from what he testified to the first time.
But
he denied
that. Credibility determinations up to the trial court, not to us.
Oh, I think so, but I think that it's important with regard to trying to find some kind of objective facts which are required by the courts that this is all subjective. This is a man's testimony that is the only thing that stands with regard to this particular term. Again, I think we can strain over a net. I don't think that the differential between whether he got a third out of the first two, but not out of the third one or the fourth one, I don't think changes whether or not this continuing contract is valid or not. It's still a contract, whether he's getting a third or he's getting nothing. It's still a contract. He is still the person that was our face. This is who we dealt with, was the appellee in this case. With regard to the damages, I think that we are entitled to the benefit of the bargain. Unfortunately, the benefit of the bargain was somewhat incalculable. We know what the out-of-pocket loss was. It was $873,000. The profit was incalculable because Mr. Sicking, at the time of trial and in deposition, which is all in the record, took the Fifth Amendment and basically refused to answer any questions about what happened to our cattle, where our cattle went, where our cattle were sold. If they were sold, did he buy more cattle? Took the Fifth Amendment on everything. The appellee at deposition did not take the Fifth. He answered, and basically he said he didn't know the answers to any of these things. He didn't know where our cattle were. He didn't know if we bought them, he didn't know if he sold them, he didn't know what he did with them, and he didn't know what he did with the money. And so basically there was no way for us, under those circumstances, and there were no records of any of this, there was no way to make any type of determination of what the profit was. So we believe that the proper measure of damage under contract was our out-of-pocket losses. We believe that is true in a tort situation. Now, we believe, again, that the trial court erred in its what I'll call third kind of amalgamated finding, and that was the finding that dealt with false representation, misrepresentation by the appellee. And we think that the finding basically has nothing to do with anything. The important thing is that there are no findings that address the issue of fraud by non-disclosure. Now, we filed a request for amended findings of fact, trying to get the trial court to address, by finding a fact, all of these questions. And notwithstanding that the judge, on the record, said she was very concerned about some of the nondisclosure elements in this case, basically made no findings with regard to the nondisclosure. And the main thing is that notwithstanding he reneged on the testimony about being previously cheated by this man, but there was a consent decree entered into with the United States Department of Agriculture by Mr. Sicking that the defendant knew about and told no one about. This said he was not registered.
And you said in your brief that the defendant knew that your client didn't know about the consent decree. Where in the evidence?
That's in the record, Your Honor. That's in the record of the trial itself.
Who testified to that?
Mr. Walterscheid.
There's two Mr. Walterscheid.
I'm sorry.
Can you be more
My
specific?
Client testified that he was never told that there was a consent decree.
Okay, but
that's
you
different.
Said that's different than what I just asked you. You said that the defendant knew the plaintiff didn't know about it. Where is the evidence to support that?
I don't know. I have to check on that, and I can do that by supplement.
Okay.
But the consent decree is important, and I'll discuss it on my rebuttal.
May it please the court. Again, Daryl Comer on behalf of the appellee. Because the trial record is void of sufficient evidence of certain essential elements and terms necessary to establish a valid contract, and since the record does not contain sufficient evidence of a breach of contract by appellee, we're asking the court to affirm the trial court's decision to deny appellant's breach of contract claim.
Let me ask you right up front.
Okay.
Do you agree that this is a de novo review?
No, Your Honor. I believe it's a hybrid review. I believe there's since it's factual, there's legal and factual questions.
But his position is, since there aren't sufficient findings of fact to support the conclusions of law, that makes this a complete de novo review.
Well, as the court's aware, the appellate courts aren't bound by whether it's titled conclusions of law, findings of fact, what they're titled. You can review that. Obviously, the trial court found that there were insufficient facts to establish a contract. I believe since the appellant is challenging on factual and legal grounds, I believe that there's a mixed question of law and fact, and therefore it's not necessarily a straight-up de novo review. I believe the applying the standards reviewing court defers to trial court's factual determination of the facts, and if they're supported by the evidence, then reviews the legal determinations de novo. I think it's important to point out to the court, as y'all hit on earlier, that one of the major functions of a fact finder in a judicial proceeding is to determine the credibility of the witness and the weight of the evidence. In this case, the trial judge was the fact finder. Therefore, the trial judge was in the best position to determine the credibility of the witnesses and the weight of the evidence. In this case, the record is clear that the appellant, Mr. Lloyd Walterscheid, does his best to try to minimize and downplay his relationship with Clint Sicking, who I think the record is clear is the one who absconded with my client and the appellant's cattle. But at trial, the appellant downplays, says he'd never met Mr. Sicking before, didn't even know Mr. Sicking. Now, for the court's knowledge, all three of these parties involved grew up in a small town called Munster, Texas. Population less than 2,000. It's a small community, and they've all been involved in cattle. After Mr. Lloyd Walterscheid's testimony that he'd never met Mr. Sicking before, didn't know him, he later recanted and said, well, he may have hauled some cattle for me and my brother. I think it's also important to note that appellant also stated that he'd never purchased cattle before until he bought this piece of property just before all these events occurred. However, testimony came up in the trial from Mr. Sicking that he had hauled cattle for the appellant and his brother's cattle operation out in Marysville, Texas, as far back as 2008. Later, and it's in the appellant's brief on page 20, there's a footnote that Well, appellant now may concede that he may have had some cattle dealings with Sicken in the past. That's huge to me in this case, because that's a big credibility point. You know, Mr. Lloyd Walter Shy, the appellant, tries to downplay that he really didn't know much about the cattle business, that he had, first time he ever acquired cattle was when he purchased this ranch. It's just not true. He had dealt with cattle for a number of years, as the testimony shows in the record down the road.
If there wasn't a contract between the parties, what was there? What was going on? What's your theory?
So I'm going to say this is a case of the men of the round table. There's a country corner store up in Munster and my client, the appellee, manages that store. They have a table where a lot of the men come in. They sit and talk and transact business and discuss things. They wanted to start a livestock auction, so they formed a corporation called the LI Group, which is was a party to this case, to buy a livestock barn, which they did. Once the livestock barn was purchased, Clint Sicking approached my client and said, "Hey, Lloyd Walter Shy, the appellant, has some cattle he wants to sell. You should contact him and see if he wants to run through the sell barn." My client did. He contacted the appellant, and it's in the record. Appellant did sell the cattle through the sell barn. All the parties' record shows were happy. It was a successful transaction. My client then would disagree with the solicitation allegations from the appellant. The record shows that the appellant actually approached my client, the appellee, and informed him he wanted to buy some bred heifers.
It's undisputed, though, that your client did accept the checks from Lloyd, and he did transfer those checks to Mr. Sicking, and that he did keep an accounting of those checks, however bad the accounting may be. Is that correct?
That is correct. He gave paper receipts for the number of cattle. What would happen is Mr. Sicking dealt with cattle back and forth. Well, let me answer the question as far as the checks.
What Justice Sutterith is asking is, if there is no contract, what's your theory on what your client's role in this whole dispute was?
Well, that's where I was going with the LI Group and the sell barn. The appellant also then invested into the LI Group as well. There was discussion about purchasing some cattle for market support to try to help get this sell barn going. They wanted to have a certain number of cattle, so the buyers would come in to purchase cattle from them. And Mr. Walterside invested cattle. He also wanted to buy some bred heifers. So the first two transactions, there was 9 total transactions that were involved in this, and the first two transactions involved a mix of market support cows and what we called wheat cattle. Some of the cattle would go to Lloyd Walterside to be put on wheat pastures. He agreed that they'd be managed and cared for by Clint Sicking. The other market support cows were to be managed and cared for by Clint Sicking and then ran through the sell barn for market support. This is where the discussion of, hey, let's run these through the sell barn. If we make a profit, let's split the profits 3 ways on this. I think it's important to note that was a discussion. If you look at the record...
Well, isn't that a contract, if everybody agreed to it?
If everyone agreed to it, Judge, but there's missing terms of how many cattle are we going to run through. What they did is ran cattle through, sold, and purchased additional cattle.
Tell me just a sentence. What's your theory on what your client's role was? That's what I want to hear. If there wasn't a contract, what was his role in all this? Can you tell me one sentence?
He took money from the client and gave per penny to Mr. Sicking for the purchase of the cattle. That was his primary role.
Monetary benefit? No. He just did it just to do it?
Yes, and he did it for other members of the round table, if you will, some other investors of LI Group. As a matter of fact, it's in the record that there's another...
Why was there a need for a middleman?
Convenience. They'd write the check and give it to Mr. Walterside. I agree it's a bad practice, but they'd give him the check and he'd turn around and write the check out. The record shows Mr. Felderhoff did the same thing. The difference with Mr. Felderhoff is... he put the cattle on his property and kept the cattle. He didn't rely upon Clint Sicking to care for the cattle and take care of the cattle. But there was no benefit to my client there other than trying to appease the other investors and work with these guys for the LI Group. There were 9 transactions in this. But even in the first, I think it's important for the court to note that even the appellant's own testimony was as far as even the first two, the market support cattle, his understanding, he says, I thought we were going to split the profits. My client says that they discussed splitting in thirds.
Well, if the guy split the profits, he wasn't just a middleman, was he?
Not on the market support cattle. But those were in the first two transactions, and only part of the cattle. We don't have the number.
So you don't think those first two transactions inform as to the latter transactions?
That's correct, Judge.
I think they're just separate, and we shouldn't. They're standalone.
Is there a contract for the first two transactions?
No, because the missing terms are, okay, they're running the cattle over to support the market. When are you
just told us they've agreed to split. You'll concede that they've agreed to split it three ways, at least with regards to the market support cattle.
My client says they discussed splitting any profits, if there were any profits, split the market support cattle by thirds. The appellant testified, this is in the Reporter's Record, Volume 2, page 59, lines 10 through 12. I don't remember exactly how profits are going to be split, but I think Danny was going to get a percentage of it. The record is full of, I assumed we were going to do this, I thought we were going to do this, I assumed. They never had a meeting of the minds, and the trial court touched on that in the trial, that they don't understand the meeting of the minds. When were the cattle going to be sold? When were the profits going to be split? How many cattle are going to be sold? How many times are they going to be rolled over as far as the market support? Then roll over to the other cattle, what we are calling the weak cattle. Those cattle were to be purchased. My client had no interest whatsoever, not even discussion of interest in that. Appellant says he assumed that my client was going to have an interest in profits in that. But I think that's rebutted by appellant's own testimony, in that he had some wheat cattle that he sold on his own to his brother-in-law. And did he split any profits with my client? No. But after this all goes down, now he says, well, I think we had an agreement to split some profits on these wheat cattle as well. What is clear from the record, and again, I strongly disagree with appellant's statement that my client promised to watch over these cattle. It's very clear from the record that appellant knew that Mr. Sicking was going to care and feed for the cattle. That after the cattle were purchased, my client had nothing to do with the cattle. My client didn't take care of them, didn't transport them, didn't feed them. And if you look at the record, it's clear that these cattle transactions that are involved in this suit occurred between March 9, 2015 and June 10, 2015. The last two transactions, the appellant wrote checks directly to Clint Sicking for the purchase of cattle, didn't write the check to my client. After May of 2000, so my client was no longer involved in any of those transactions as of May 2015, as far as taking the check, depositing it, and writing another check out within 24 hours to Mr. Sicking. Appellant testifies that he saw the cattle, that he was confident in May that he had all of his cattle that he was supposed to have. That would have been after my client had any kind of involvement, even in writing the check. Mr. Walterscheid, the appellant's testimony is that up until September 2015, he was confident that he had his cattle, as he would drive by and he would see cattle, and that his investment of cattle were collateralized. Again, he also concedes in his testimony multiple times, multiple places, as pointed out in my brief, that he understood Clint Sicking was going to be managing and caring for the cows and taking care of the cows, and that my client had no responsibility in doing that. In September, Clint Sicking approaches Mr. Walterscheid and presents him a bad check, and that's when all this kind of went downhill. There was absolutely no evidence that my client had anything to do with the appellant's cattle disappearing. As to the fraud, the appellant's relying on a fraud by non-disclosure, and as I cited in my brief, cited the Schoenberger case and Horizon Shipbuilding Inc. The elements to prove that there was a fraud by non-disclosure includes In item four, the defendant knew the plaintiff was ignorant of the facts and plaintiff did not have an equal opportunity to discover the facts. I think Justice Gabriel hit on that topic just a minute ago, was there was absolutely no evidence that a defendant didn't know or was ignorant of the facts and that my client didn't know that he knew, didn't know that. There's also no evidence that the plaintiff did not have an equal opportunity to discover the facts. It was a consent decree. You can pull up online. And as far as the Texas Theft Liability Act, there was absolutely no evidence or insufficient evidence that...
Well, by telling him that Mr. Sicking would take care of the cows and pay money back, doesn't that leave a false impression that this is someone that you can trust when he knew it wasn't someone you could trust?
Well, I think it's important to know that Appellee also bought cattle from Mr. Sicking. It was in the same boat. Mr. Sicking...
Okay, that doesn't answer my question. My question is, doesn't that leave a false... Just looking at that, doesn't that leave a false impression with someone who may not have the same information he does?
If it's someone that doesn't have a relationship with that person, absolutely. But I think, given the history, I think that's why the history of the business transaction, the cattle transactions between the appellant before these transactions is important.
That he may have hauled some cows for him years before that?
Well, he's hauling cattle for him as recently as right before this. He's the one that made my client aware that Mr. the appellant had cattle to sell. And if I may, just real quick on the theft liability, there was no evidence that my client was in control of the cattle or intended to deprive the appellant of his money or cattle. And I know I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A brief rejoinder, please. And that is that I think that the court has hit upon what I think Justice Sutter had said it better than I could say it, and that is all we dealt with in the first seven transactions was the appellee. All we're suing the appellee for are the seven transactions that we dealt only with him. He got the money. He kept the records. He's going to watch over it. He gave us receipts. The one check we got back, he gave it to us. And what the court said was, if this is not a contract, what is it? And I think that's the $64 question. You know, these transactions did not happen over a period of years. They happened in 60 days, these seven transactions. These happened one right after the other. You know, where that Danny would come to Lloyd and said, Clint's got another 50 cattle. Can you give us $100,000? And he'd write another check for $100,000. And it's, as we've said, we believe this should be a continuing contract that went on. I think it is ironic here that we are arguing about whether
the agreement with regard to the market, the agreement if there is one, with regard to the market cattle should guide what we think the agreement would be with regard to the wheat cattle.
The answer is we think it's the same, and I think that my client was quite consistent when he testified to that, notwithstanding Mr. Comer's statement that my client assumed this and assumed that. Mr. Falls has gone through these so-called assumptions in the reply brief starting on page 12, and I think he has put all of these so-called assumptions into proper context. I think that my client understood what the transaction was and what the terms were, and I don't think there's really much dispute about any of this. It's just the dispute is the court reaching the conclusion that this was not a contract. That's the dispute. I was saying, I think it's ironic that they basically, in their counterclaim against Mr. Sicking, copied our pleadings. And so the very relief that we are here arguing about whether or not this is a contract formed the basis for the relief that Mr. Danny Walterscheid got from Mr. Sicking. He got a judgment against him also. And you know, it's exactly the same pleadings. They're virtually word for word. I will conclude.
If we assume there is a contract, what's the evidence that we can conclusively say, reversing the trial judge, that there was a breach here by Danny?
I think there's three things. One is that, of course, we never got any of our money back. Number one, we gave him the money and we never got any back. But moreover, I think it is clear that he conceded, he told Lloyd that he had a duty to watch over these cattle, and he didn't do it. obviously. I mean, the whole thing just got lost. I mean, we never got any money back. Where'd this cattle go? I kept saying to everybody, subpoena another bank. Where did the money go? And the bottom line is he didn't watch over it. And of course, and I believe that the third
breaching would be not watching over it, not giving a promised return on the money. Isn't that correct?
It could be. I think it could be one or the other. And then the other thing was is that he promised to keep an accounting, which, as I've already stated twice now, I mean, he basically said, in retrospect, it all looks like I phonied the whole thing up. I mean, he did try to keep some kind of accounting records. But what happened is that no one knew where any of this cattle went. Where the money went, nobody has a clue. It just vanished. I would conclude with regard to the watchover. I think it's an interesting, here's some answers from Mr. Walterscheid at trial about his duty to watch over. He said, well, I did talk to Lloyd to make sure, I mean to Clint, to make sure he gets Lloyd taken care of on the situation. I didn't know what the numbers were or anything of that nature. He goes on to say, I told him to take care, make sure. I called Clint up on a regular basis and texted him, you've got Lloyd taken care of, haven't you? He would always say yes. And I said then, well, Lloyd would come to me and say, I ain't got nothing yet. What's going on with my cattle? And I'd bring it to Clint's attention again. If this isn't a contract, I don't know what it is. Thank you for your time.
Gentlemen, thank you for your argument this afternoon. Your case has been submitted. We've got